Now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
You know, I think your brain produces a chemical that blocks out my voice.
What?
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is the gold standard. Each of my guests is the gold standard in his or her profession. My next guest is a scientist and former British Airways employee turned creativity consultant. He'll teach us creative science experiments that we can conduct on board an airplane from his latest book, In Flight Science. And if you have a question or if you'd like to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Brian Clegg has written for a number of popular science books. His latest is titled In Flight Science, which explores the science that's all around you inside and outside your window when you're flying on an airplane. Brian is also the editor of the successful www.popularscience.co.uk book review and a fellow at the Royal Society of Arts. Brian has his master's degree from Cambridge University in natural science and from Lancaster University in operational research. From Lancaster, he joined British Airways, where he ran a team that included emerging technologies amongst the most eclectic and talented staff in the company. In 1994, he left British Airlines to set up his own creative consultancy, running courses on the development of new ideas and products and the creative solution of business problems. Joining us from London, hi Brian, how are you today?
Good morning. I'm fine, thanks.
Well, thank you, and thank you for taking time away from it's dinner time where you are, or tea time, I should say, more appropriately, where you are. So thank you for joining us today. I love to fly, personally, and I think it's one of the most miraculous things that one can do in one's life. You work for British Airways, which is one of the great air carriers in the world today, yet you're a wussy boy when it comes to flying. You don't like it particularly. So how can a scientist such as yourself, who understands and appreciates the physics of flight, how can you not be in love with the idea of flying?
I guess partly it's because when I worked at British Airways, I just flew so much that it lost its thrill. And in some ways, that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, to bring it back, because I think flying ought to have a sense of wonder about it. It's something exciting. It's something amazing. And yet it's so easy to get blasé about it and just take it for granted.
Well, there's no doubt about it. So I can understand burnout, and I certainly can appreciate that. But why did you write In Flight Science? I mean, particularly, it wasn't just to get over your own blasé-ness towards flying. You had some very specific purposes in mind when you wrote the book, didn't you?
Well, that's right. I love communicating science. It is what I like doing best. And it's finding some way to make it more approachable that's so important. I think it's just a great opportunity that when you're on a plane, you're experiencing science all around you. So I saw it either as a way that you could literally take the book on the airplane with you and actually be looking at it as you fly, or just thinking about flying. There's so many opportunities to find amazing science going on around you.
Well, that there are. There's no question about it, and it is fun. So I want to ask you a more broad-based question, if I can, Brian, and it's regards science, because most people, once they leave school, they kind of shy away from science. That's the end of that. I've closed that chapter of my life. I'm never going to think about it again. In what ways does the modern curriculum squash our interest and our excitement in science, would you say?
Well, I think part of the problem is we tend to do the boring bits at school. We do what are called 19th century science, really. You know, we don't have the really exciting stuff that's happening, say, in physics. There's not a lot of quantum physics. There's not a lot of relativity. There's not a lot of particle physics. All the exciting stuff in physics. And it's the same, really, with biology. It's the basic original stuff that they would have done 100 years ago is mostly what we do in school. And I think one of the great things about writing popular science like I do is you can do the fun bits. You can actually encourage people back into science by opening up those exciting things that you don't necessarily get at school.
Well, that is true. But how do you get ordinary citizens like myself excited about quantum physics? I mean, you need a whole basis of understanding in science before you can tackle something as sophisticated as quantum physics, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, obviously, if you're going to want to go out and do a bit of the actual physics and, you know, work out some theories for yourself, yes, sure, you need to work at it for a few years. But if all you want to do is get a feeling for what it's about, and in the end, quantum physics is basically about how everything's put together, because everything we know, ourselves, our planet, our universe, is built of quantum particles. What particles that behave in the most amazing and strange ways, then finding out about that, I think, is just fascinating. And you don't need to be a geek sort of thing to get excited by it, I think.
All right. My guest is Brian Clegg. Now, Brian, let's talk about the theory of relativity, because you actually, in your book, talk about this, and it's sort of the intersection of Einstein's theory of relativity and air travel. So you assert that we get younger as we fly. How does that happen?
Well, this is one of the amazing things out of relativity. Einstein's special relativity basically says that as you travel, the faster you go, the slower time goes for you. It's really something to do with light. It's a result of his discovery that light travels the same speed however you move with respect to it. That's the relativity bit. And if you do the math, what falls out of that is basically that the faster you go, the slower time goes for you. Now, it's not a huge effect of the sort of speed we're going on a plane. So say you cross the Atlantic every week for 40 years, you'll be maybe a thousandth of a second younger. So the people who make anti-aging creams aren't going to worry about it too much, but I still think it's quite amazing.
That it is. All right, so if you cross the Atlantic from London to New York, we're getting, if you do that repeatedly, you get 1,000th of a second younger. What if you just kept going west? What if you went from London to New York, New York to Los Angeles, Los Angeles to Singapore, back to London, and just sort of circumnavigated the globe several times? Could you, in fact, become even more than 1/1,000th of a second younger?
Well, it's basically down to how long you're traveling and how fast you travel. So the faster you go, the more of an effect there is. The longer you do it, the more effect there is. What you really want to do is to get a big effect, get yourself up to about half the speed of light or something like that, which you aren't going to do on a 747, let's face it.
Not on a
747. But if you could do that, you would literally potentially get not get older as fast. I mean, a good comparison, basically, if you had a pair of twins, kept one here on the Earth and sent one off in a spaceship close to the speed of light for a while, you could have the twin come back and actually maybe be 20 years younger than the twin on Earth. It could be that sort of different.
Wow, that could be very dramatic. All right, Brian. Another very interesting thing that you talk about in your book, write about in your book, is a tidbit about radiation exposure. In what ways does air travel increase our exposure to radiation?
Okay, well, when we hear radiation, we immediately think things like nuclear power stations, atomic bombs,
right,
things of that sort. But actually, radiation is totally natural. There is radiation around us all the time. And the radiation here we're concerned with is something called cosmic rays. So there's something that batter the Earth from space all the time. And because you're higher up in a plane, there's less atmosphere to protect you from the cosmic rays. So you get exposed to a little bit more radiation than you would normally. But to put it into context, different parts of the country also have different levels of radiation. So, for instance, if you go somewhere like Denver, there's a relatively high background radiation. It's more than twice as high as it would be somewhere like New York. So, basically, all you're doing by flying is the equivalent of moving to a slightly higher background radiation place in the country. It is not a big effect, but it is that.
But there is an effect there. All right, well, help me to understand, because I associate radiation with heat, and there's this discrepancy. If you're higher, closer to the sun, there is more radiation. You're flying at perhaps 35,000 feet where you are closer to the sun. Why is it then that the temperature outside the airplane is considerably colder than the temperature on the ground below?
It's the same also, of course, when you go up a mountain. If you go up a mountain, you'll see that you've got snow on the high mountain peaks, even in summer. And really all it is that the atmosphere acts like a blanket. It helps to keep you warm. And the further up you go, the less atmosphere there is keeping the heat in. So, in fact, you do get more energy from the sun. If you've ever been up a mountain, high mountain, you can be out in snow in short-sleeve shirt and feel nice and warm because the sun is actually keeping you warm in terms of the radiation from the sun, the light. But the ambient temperature around you is lower just because there's not enough atmosphere to keep you warm, basically.
Makes a lot of sense. My guest is Brian Clegg, author of the book In-Flight Science, A Guide to the World from Your Airplane Window. And we're talking about some of the great science that you experience on board a jetliner. Now, on a more practical level, Brian, since 9/11 in this country, there's been a real increase in security. We've got all kinds of screening devices that you have to go through at an airport before that you can get on an airplane at all. A lot of people fear that there's some damage that can be result resulting from the scans that you go through. So let's talk about the different dangers, if there in fact are any dangers from the different types of scanners, starting with, say, the metal detector that most of us go through at the airport.
Okay, well, to an ordinary person, there really is no problem at all with a metal detector. The only potential risk, and this ought to be pointed out at the airport, is if you have something like a pacemaker that could be influenced by it. But really what's happening with one of those metal detectors is it inducing a current. I guess the simplest thing, that you often have it in an electric toothbrush, where you sort of sit the electric toothbrush on a charger, and there are no wires actually connected to it, and the electricity is induced in the toothbrush. And it's a bit similar to that, but much, much weaker. Then any bits of metal you're carrying will have a very small current induced in them by this magnetic ring, and that produces an effect that can be detected. But there really is no risk at all to people from those.
Well, that's good. That puts my mind at ease about that. But a little bit more controversial in our country are these full body scanners that you go through. And then, you know, can you see people's undies and all of that kind of stuff? But is there any fear or any threat from those full body scanners if you're selected in, from the crowd to be screened that way?
Okay, well, the most risk you're at with those is probably, there are two different types, but the one that probably is the most risky, if there is any risk, is the ones that use x-rays. Because x-rays, again, we're talking radiation, not as strong, actually, as the cosmic rays from space, but x-rays are a form of radiation. You get exposed to too much x-rays, it can cause damage. It can cause damage to the cells in your body. But these are actually very low-energy x-rays. They have to be, because the idea is they go through your clothes, but they bounce off your skin. So they're not strong enough to get through your skin. And I think a good sort of thing that puts them in proportion, if you remember, the background level of radiation is increased when you're flying, and the amount of radiation you get from one of these scanners is the equivalent of being in the air about a minute, just over a minute. And so it's a tiny amount of extra radiation compared to even what you get on a flight.
Oh, that's good. That is good. That helps to put my mind at ease about that. My guest is Brian Clegg. Now, Brian, the American singer Judy Collins, she sang that "I really don't know clouds at all" in her popular song "Both Sides Now." But unlike Ms. Collins, you really do know something about clouds. What is it about clouds that amazes you, and why?
I think there's a couple of things about clouds, really. I mean, one is just that they actually stay up. When you think about it, clouds are basically drops of water. We tend to think of them as being water vapor, but they're not. They're not a gas. They're actually little drops of actual water up there. That's why you can see them. You can't see the gas. There's water vapor. And the immediate thought then is, why don't they fall out of the sky? And the thing that I find quite amazing is actually they do. Clouds do fall. But the fact is, those drops of water in them are so incredibly small that to them, the air molecules around them seem quite big. And to them, getting through the air is a bit like getting through really thick molasses. It's hard and impossible to get through at all. So clouds do fall, but they only fall about 3 feet in a year. They fall so slowly that you can't actually see it happening. But I still think it's kind of nice that they do.
Well, it is. And that brings to mind the very popular saying, "I'm on cloud nine." Mm-hmm. And there's actually some sort of scientific basis to that saying. What is meant by the expression, "I'm on cloud nine"?
There is a scientific basis. You're right. Basically, clouds are classified into different types that come at different levels. And the classification system used to run from 1 to 9. So the highest cloud, which is a big cumulonimbus thundercloud that can go up to about twice the height a plane flies at, they were cloud 9 because they were the highest. Now, the funny thing about that is they actually changed the system a few years ago so that there were 10 different types of cloud. So cloud 10 would actually be the highest one. But the organization that arranges these things had a sort of romantic moment and decided that they'd shift the scale. So instead of running from 1 to 10, it would run from 0 to 9. So that way 9 was still the highest and you were still on cloud 9 when you're on top of the world.
Let's hear it for nostalgia and romanticism. I think that's great. My guest is Brian Clegg. Now, Brian, you and I are very fortunate because we speak English. What is the official language of air travel?
English again. Really, you have to have a standardized language, because if you had somebody from, say, a Chinese airplane talking to the ground control in China in Chinese language, then the trouble is that any other pilots in the area wouldn't necessarily understand it, because pilots are going to be coming from all different countries. So you do need a standard language. And for some while, that has now been established as English. So, say, a French pilot will talk to a French air traffic controller in English, so all the other pilots around them can understand what's going on.
Ah, that's phenomenal, and it makes me feel good that I know English as my first language. My guest is Brian Clegg. Brian, bringing it back home to Great Britain there, an invention during World War II that actually saved Great Britain during the Battle of Britain was radar. And you all invented that, and that was the great deterrent and allowed the British forces to hold off the larger Luftwaffe. But in fact, radar was not originally developed as a tracking technology. Tell us about the invention of radar by Nikola Tesla.
Well, Tesla was an amazing character. He spent most of his working life in America, and he devised things like the alternating current system for electricity. He was a big showman as well in terms of electricity, and did amazing things. And sometimes he would make claims that were totally dramatic. So he said that it was possible to make a death ray out of strong radio, so effectively out of the kind of thing that would be used for radar, for a particular frequency of radio. Now, what was happening when radar was first invented was they were actually looking into, in a lab in the UK, whether it really was possible to use Tesla's death rays and kill people with these strong radio beams. That didn't work, but what they found was they could use them for detecting incoming planes, for reflecting their signal off the plane and seeing them coming in. So even though it was a wacky idea in terms of his original intention, it proved incredibly valuable.
Well, let's hear it for unintended consequences. My guest has been Brian Clegg, author of the book In Flight Science, A Guide to the World from Your Airplane Window. Brian, if people are intrigued by what they've heard from you, they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, my website, which is Brian Clegg, that's BRIANCLEGG.net.
BrianClegg.net. Brian, it has been a delight. Thank you for taking time away from tea to join us. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.